explore the many decades of popular music Thursday nights on Round Trip with Neil at the Wheel. Two solid commercial-free hours of rock, blues, jazz, folk, and everything in between. That's Round Trip with Neil at the Wheel, Thursdays from 7 to 9 p.m., only on 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau.
And now, Xbox Magazine's Nerd of the Year, Mike Cannon.
Welcome to the third and final hour of this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. This hour will be featuring a 12-minute segment called This Week in Palestine, giving you a non-Zionist, non-Western point of view about the Palestinian struggle. That'll be followed by Black Agenda Radio segment, which will be followed by Between the Lines. That should take us up to the top of the hour, where we'll close with more music of love, rage, and resistance. By the way, if you have any comments, suggestions, and gripes, feel free to contact me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N, so that's one long run-on word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Thanks for taking some time to catch this week's fully independent, non-corporate radio program. Here is This Week in Palestine.
The line must be drawn here.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for September 13th through the 19th, 2008. Internal unrest in the Gaza Strip escalates this week despite rapprochement attempts in Cairo as Israeli military assaults in the West Bank continue. In Israel, ruling Kadima Party elects a new chief. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. We begin our weekly report with the anti-wall nonviolent actions in the villages of Bilayin and Nailin near Ramallah. The residents of Bilayin, joined by international and Israeli peace activists, organized a protest against the building of the wall and the settlements on Palestinian land. The protest today was also a commemoration of the 26th year since the massacre of the refugees of Sabra and Shatila refugees camp in Lebanon. The protest started after the Friday prayer. It called for an end to the Israeli policy of settlements building, closures, kidnappings, and the siege on Palestinian areas. The protesters marched towards the wall to reach the confiscated land behind it. And as usual, the gate was closed with Israeli soldiers positioned behind concrete blocks. Protesters tried to get closer to the gate. The army fired concussion grenades and CS canisters, causing dozens to suffer gas inhalation. Protesters said the troops sprayed them with blue water mixed with some kind of gas. As the skin absorbed the liquid, it caused a lot of pain to the wounded. This is not the first time Israeli soldiers used a chemical material or new weapons against Palestinians. Israeli soldiers once used some kind of sponge bullets, which stuck to the body and caused burns to the skin. In other demonstrations, troops used a gas that caused spasms to all those who inhaled it. Apparently, Israel has been testing new weapons on the people of Bilayin. In the nearby village of Nailin, the villagers also organized an anti-wall protest following the Friday prayer. Israeli troops blocked the road with the razor wire to prevent the protesters from reaching the land. As they arrived near the razor wire, troops showered them with tear gas and rubber-coated bullets. Dozens were treated for gas inhalation, while six people were directly hit by the steel bullets. Some young protesters responded to the gas and steel bullets with stones. They managed to jump over the razor wire and get a little closer to the Israeli soldiers, who in return fired more tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at them. Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported that three Israeli soldiers were lightly wounded in the demonstration. For IMEMC, this is E.L. Humble. As Palestinian-Israeli peace talks have not achieved any concrete progress on the ground, intra-Palestinian national dialogue is underway in Cairo to restore national unity in Palestine. IMEMC's Alice Gray has more.
A delegation of senior Fatah leaders from Gaza traveled to Amman on Friday, en route to Cairo, where they will join representatives of other Palestinian factions in the talks mediated by Egyptian officials. The goal of the talks is to reach a memorandum of understanding that would lead to renewed national unity. The ruling Hamas party in Gaza said this week that it welcomes any Egyptian invitation for dialogue with other Palestinian factions, including Fatah. However, Hamas lawmaker Mushir al-Masri confirmed that such dialogue should be based on respect for the 2006 Palestinian parliamentary elections which brought Hamas to power. For his part, Palestinian Legislative Council Deputy Speaker and Hamas member Ahmed Bahar called on Hamas and Fatah to put aside their differences for the sake of the national interest and engage in a serious dialogue that will lead to reconciliation. The Islamist Hamas party took over Gaza in June 2007 and ousted security services that were loyal to Fatah. Since then, Fatah leader and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has demanded that Hamas renounce its control over Gaza, while both sides have called for unconditional national dialogue. Meanwhile, an already shaky Egyptian-mediated truce deal between the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza and Israel could collapse, as representatives of these factions cast doubts this week over Israel's willingness to commit to the ceasefire. According to the Popular Committee Against the Israeli Siege on Gaza, Israel has been procrastinating in implementing the ceasefire agreement signed in June 2008. The committee says Israel has only reopened the crossings partially, allowing in limited quantities of goods and commodities. This week, Israel closed the crossings completely after two homemade shells were fired from Gaza onto nearby Israeli areas, despite the fact that the shells resulted in no casualties. Regarding the Palestinian-Israeli negotiations, senior Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat asserted that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has already rejected any partial solutions or agreements with Israel. Abbas's rejection was in response to an offer by outgoing Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, proposed that the Palestinians and Israelis seek a partial agreement excluding the status of occupied East Jerusalem. Chief negotiator Ahmed Kurey commented this week on the negotiations, saying any solution that falls short of Jerusalem is unacceptable. Meeting in Amman earlier this week, King Abdullah II of Jordan and EU Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana warned both Palestinians and Israelis against prolonging peace talks indefinitely and asked them to conclude a deal by the end of this year. In November 2007, Washington sponsored the Annapolis Peace Conference, which was supposed to lead to an agreed two-state solution by the end of 2008, as envisioned by outgoing US President George W. Bush. In Israel, Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni won her Kadima Party's leadership elections, beating her main rival, Minister of Transportation Shaul Mofaz. Mofaz announced that he would take a break from public life and decide his political future later on. In Gaza, Hamas party spokesperson Fawzi Barhoum stated that Livni's victory would mean increased Israeli aggression towards the Palestinian people, while in the West Bank, senior negotiator Saeb Erekat described the event as an Israeli internal affair. FM Livni is expected to assume the Israeli premiership soon, once current Prime Minister Olmert resigns from the post, and to try to form a new Israeli coalition government.
In Gaza this week, 12 Palestinian residents were killed and more than 40 others injured in a deadly police raid on one of Gaza City's neighborhoods. Meanwhile, Israel closed Gaza's border crossings as the 15-month-old Israeli blockade on Gaza continues. This and more with IMEMC's Rami Almeghari in Gaza.
Palestinian medical sources reported that 12 residents, including a child, were killed and more than 40 others wounded during a Hamas-led police raid against the influential Baghmashi clan in eastern Gaza City. The raid, according to police, aimed at arresting three suspects from the family who are believed to be behind a series of crimes, including the killing of a policeman on Monday afternoon. The police demanded that those wanted surrender, but they defied the order, necessitating the use of police force, according to a police spokesman. Also on the internal level, the corpse of a Palestinian man, 31-year-old Raed al-Harazin, was found in Gaza City. He was killed and tortured after being abducted from his home by unknown assailants. Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza continue to respect the ceasefire with Israel for the most part, although two homemade shells were fired from Gaza into nearby Israeli areas earlier this week. There were no casualties, but a slight property damage was reported by Israeli sources. Following the launch of these homemade shells, the Israeli occupation authorities closed the Gaza border crossings for 2 days, during which the 1.5 million residents of Gaza were deprived of essential daily supplies. Meanwhile, the chairman of the Popular Committee Against the Israeli Siege, Palestinian lawmaker Jamal al-Khudri, stated this week that despite the truce deal, Israel has not eased its blockade on Gaza as required. Al-Khudri reported that only 30% of the essential supplies and commodities needed by Gaza's population have been made available since Israel began partially reopening the collapsed crossings 3 months ago. In June, both Israel and the ruling Hamas party in Gaza agreed to an Egyptian brokered ceasefire deal, stipulating that Israel gradually lifts its blockade on Gaza and Palestinian factions stop firing homemade shells into nearby Israeli areas. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
Israeli military assaults on the occupied West Bank area continued throughout the week, resulting in death, injury, and kidnapping. Meanwhile, Palestinian security services conducted their own arrest campaigns against Hamas supporters, according to Hamas sources. IMEMC's George Reshmawi has the details.
Early this week, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 17-year-old Palestinian in the village of Tekoa near the West Bank city of Bethlehem. He was shot in the chest at close range and died while being transported to a local hospital. Meanwhile, two Palestinian residents of Nablus were wounded this week after Israeli settlers from the nearby illegal settlement of Yitzhar hurled stones at them. Also this week, Israeli troops attacked many West Bank population centers, including cities and villages, kidnapping several residents. The kidnapping took place amidst Israeli military invasions into cities such as Nablus, Jenin, Ramallah, Bethlehem, Tulkarim, and Qalqilya. In these assaults, Israeli soldiers ransacked houses before forcing residents outside and detaining allegedly wanted Palestinians. The Israeli military forces invaded several cities on daily basis in the West Bank, where Israel continues to maintain military control even in areas run by the Palestinian Authority. On the other hand, a Palestinian man stabbed an Israeli soldier near the West Bank city of Jericho. Israeli sources said the man snatched the soldier's rifle before escaping to Ramallah. The soldier was wounded and evacuated to hospital for treatment, the sources added. At the internal level, according to the ruling Hamas party in Gaza, the Fatah Allied Security Services of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank rounded up more than 15 Hamas supporters this week. Hamas has instructed its supporters in the West Bank to defy such arrests. For IMEMC, this is George Shmawi.
And that was just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant update, check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by Usam Kassis and E.L. Humble.
Senator McCain, one of your top advisors, Carly Fiorina, said that Sarah Palin is not qualified to run a corporation.
Well, I'm sure she was just misunderstood.
Well, when she was asked about it the next day, she said that not only is Sarah Palin not qualified to run a corporation, that neither are you.
She said that? Excuse me a minute. Carly? How the hell am I supposed to make people think I can run a country if I can't even run my own campaign?
My name isn't Carly, sir.
Well, then who the hell is Carly?
The quickening pace of economic disasters, one cascading upon the other in quick succession, sometimes makes mere reporting feel strangely biblical. It is as if the body of corporate globalism screams from all its orifices, rocked with spasms of convulsive irrationality. Amidst the howling, corporate servants litter the media landscape with counterfeit analyses designed to blame everyone but the lords of capital for the unfolding nightmare. By the time the true causes of one disaster become clear, another onslaught is upon us from yet a different sector of the political economy, bringing more mayhem for which the ruling classes are once again declared blameless. The oil price storm surge that peaked at $147 a barrel in early July, then subsided to a few bucks more than $100 by September, had no direct connection to the size of planetary oil reserves, and very little to do with demand from fast-growing markets like China and India. As should be clear now that the surge is over, the explosion in oil prices that inflicted untold and ongoing damage on oil-consuming countries was caused primarily by speculators, who also hold permanent membership in the ruling class of the Western world. There is no mystery to the culprit's identity, Outfits like Goldman Sachs, Barack Obama's biggest campaign contributor and past and present employer of so many of his top advisors, and their fellow billionaire bandits in John McCain's corner. There is no question of their guilt. Nobody else has both the capital and the mechanisms, the exchanges for trading energy commodities, to pull off a caper so large and complex. As sustained and clearly massive speculative pressures push petroleum prices far beyond the short-range ambitions of any OPEC member nation, the U.S. and Israel battered Iran with threats of apocalypse in the Persian Gulf. In effect, Washington and Tel Aviv waged a kind of terror campaign against the world to create a perfect storm in oil markets. An especially scary June 6th Israeli threat to strike Iran caused an immediate $11 spike in the cost of crude. The American and Israeli threats to Iran's existence greatly accelerated and made more terrifying this spring and summer's oil price nightmare. We can roughly date the beginning of the end of the crisis to mid-July, when the Bush regime stopped screaming like a banshee and agreed to meet at arm's length with an Iranian diplomat. The Israelis also turned down the decibels, and the price of oil went into its slide towards $100. When OPEC last week voted to reduce oil production, the price of crude went up only $2 per barrel, definitive proof that the months of high-priced agony had little to do with Chinese and Indian demand, and everything to do with Western speculators and U.S. and Israeli threats of war. Now, the Americans are about to stir up the pot again, attempting to provoke Iran through sanctions against her shipping lines. Israel will no doubt rev up its war hysteria machine. A bill that would stop energy speculation will probably get nowhere in the U.S. Congress, not with any teeth in it anyway. What good would it do? Goldman Sachs and the other speculators own both political parties. The lords of capital have total immunity. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present economist Max Wolf, who examines the collapse of major financial institutions, the damaged U.S. economy, and the links to deregulation policy advocated by conservative economists and politicians. Anita Weiss, professor of international studies at the University of Oregon, who assesses the negative consequences of unauthorized U.S. military raids inside Pakistan. And Carrie Saint-Pay of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program near New Orleans, who discusses the natural protection from hurricanes that is lost with the destruction of coastal wetlands. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On Tuesday, September 16th, Bolivian troops arrested Leopoldo Fernandez, the rightist governor of Pando Northern Province, an opponent of Bolivia's leftist president, Evo Morales. Fernandez has been taken to the capital of La Paz and is being charged with genocide for allegedly ordering the deaths of at least 15 peasants who were machine-gunned during the past 2 weeks of unrest in Bolivia. Dozens of others have been wounded in the violence. The unrest was triggered by Morales' plan to conduct a nationwide referendum in January 2009 to approve a new constitution, which would give the indigenous population of Bolivia more power, allow Morales to run for a consecutive second term, and give land to landless peasants. Although Morales won 67% support in a recall referendum vote last month, conservative leaders of four out of Bolivia's nine states are demanding greater autonomy and a larger share of revenue from gas sales. The majority of energy fields are located in opposition strongholds. Evo Morales and Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez have accused Washington of provoking the violence. In protest, Bolivia and Venezuela have both expelled their U.S. ambassadors. The U.S. responded by expelling Bolivian and Venezuelan ambassadors and evacuating Peace Corps volunteers from Bolivia. The Union of South American Nations, or UNASUR, held a summit meeting in Chile to address the crisis in Bolivia and issued a statement of support for Morales. The high price of oil has changed the financial calculation of outsourcing production to China and other developing countries. Higher energy and shipping costs and a stronger American dollar convinced Excel Outdoors, a sporting goods manufacturer, to halt production of sleeping bags in China and open a factory in Haleyville, Alabama. According to the Washington Post, surging shipping costs now eat up half of the $10 retail price of an Excel sleeping bag at Walmart. Rising energy costs have forced manufacturers to rethink the value of production hubs across East Asia, putting pressure on small factories in China and Vietnam. At the same time, some companies have reopened plants in the United States and in northern Mexico. Thomasville Furniture made headlines over the summer when the company announced it was returning its entire production line to the United States. Although thousands of factory shops have closed in China in recent months, China remains one of the fastest-growing economies in the world. It retains a competitive edge against the United States and Europe with low material costs and a low-wage, non-union labor force. Supermax prisons seen on TV are represented as the most advanced in management of dangerous inmates. In these secured housing units, inmates are locked in a solitary cell 23 hours a day, monitored by cameras, and fed through a tiny slot in the prison door. Since the Supermax was developed in the early 1980s, harsh conditions at the high-tech prisons have come to light. They have a heavy concentration of mentally ill inmates and experience a high rate of suicide. Bonnie Kerness of the American Friends Service Committee told Alternet that conditions in the Supermax prisons amount to torture. 10% of all inmates in local, state, and federal prisons are now in solitary confinement. In addition, 40% of all prison suicides occur in isolation. Starting in the mid-1990s, citizen groups began organizing against Supermax complexes. Prisoner advocates have won some significant legal victories in recent months. New York State has banned solitary confinement for inmates with psychological disabilities. In Mississippi, the ACLU forced the reform of the Mississippi State Penitentiary, which once held over 1,000 inmates in solitary confinement. In an agreement with the Civil Liberties Group, the state has reduced the number in isolation by 90%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Fear gripped U.S. and world markets as American investment bank Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy protection, Merrill Lynch was taken over by Bank of America, and mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac came under the control of the U.S. government. An estimated $700 billion was lost to those investing in retirement plans, government pension funds, and other investment portfolios. Wall Street saw a loss of value of more than 4% on September 15th, following Lehman Brothers' collapse, the biggest crash since the September 11th attacks. Stock markets in London and Tokyo fell to their lowest levels in more than 3 years. Much of the instability can be tied to bad loans made in the subprime mortgage market. Financial analysts looking for the next domino to fall were closely watching American International Group, or AIG, after the world's largest insurer's stock fell by some 60% and losses of almost $20 billion. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with economist Max Wolf, who examines the collapse of major financial institutions, the damaged U.S. economy, and the links to deregulation policy advocated by conservative economists and politicians.
It seems to be raining banks and bankers, and when it rains, it pours, apparently, in this business. So in the last 3 months, we've seen three of the five U.S. investment banks cease to exist either at all or as independent, starting in mid-March with the demise of Bear Stearns. It has been a season of trouble on Wall Street, and I think this pain both started outside of the financial markets and has already spilled well outside the financial markets, whether that's the massive 50% approximate sell-off in Chinese shares, or the seizure in the Russian markets that shut down their market, or the rising unemployment, or the rising misery of the general public here as wage growth stagnates and employment growth stagnates.
Max Wolf, how much of what we're seeing unfold on Wall Street is tied directly with deregulation policy that have been pushed by successive presidents, conservative economists, and politicians?
Part of what's changed in our deregulation is that we've deregulated both who can lend money, so it's not just the banks, what the banks can do inside each country in terms of lending money, and what banks and other firms can do in terms of international transactions. And part of what that's produced is a shift from what we used to call the originate-to-own model of lending to the originate-to-distribute model of lending. Under the originate-to-own model of lending, banks generally would make loans, and then they would enter a long-term partnership in which their prospects, their futures, and the futures of those people to whom they lent were wed, and so they would be cautious and careful, and sometimes also racist and discriminatory, but cautious and careful with who they lent money to and how much they lent and under what terms. In the age of international capital flows and deregulation, money from all over the world can zoop across international borders multiple times in a deal, and more banks and increasingly what they call non-bank financial intermediaries, which means not a regulated bank entity but someone who lends money, began the originate-to-distribute way of operating as financial firms, in which they made loans for the express purpose of selling them to someone else as fast as possible. Wall Street got in on that by securitizing these loans, which is a sort of fancy phrase for chopping them up and reformulating them into a mystery meat of different debts and then selling them around the world. And that's part of how this bubble got so big, a huge part of it, and why this bubble is so painful and so international as it busts and the shock waves ripple out from ground zero, which is more or less the American subprime borrower. But increasingly, it affects college loans, credit card loans, auto loans, and prime home mortgage loans, as well as subprime home mortgage loans, where the trouble began.
Max Wolf, when you hear John McCain say that the fundamentals of the U.S. economy are quite strong, and you hear comments by Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama on what he would do if he were president to address these financial issues, what's your assessment of these two candidates and their prescriptions?
It looks like John McCain is doing something that sadly many in the mainstream press and an awful lot of citizens, our fellow citizens, have been doing, which is to kind of hope that this goes away by sheer force of will and pretending it's not here. And when McCain says the fundamentals are strong and he doesn't see much, you kind of wonder who he's kidding and what he thinks he's going to get out of saying that. So that is very much not hope-inspiring. When I hear it, I find it kind of shocking, and it seems a very poor electoral strategy and very strange. On the other hand, when I listen to Barack Obama talk about it, it reminds me of the worst of student oral presentations in my classes, in which you have a perfectly bright student who's clearly skimmed instead of read the material and is straining to remember the 10% of it he knew 10 minutes ago. So it does not sound like someone who's particularly knowledgeable, interested, or involved in these issues. And that's also upsetting because I expect some greater insight and possibly forward-looking solution from Senator Obama, and also because this is huge, it's here, it's now. And I have virtually no doubt that by November, when the elections roll around, the economic turmoil, the number of people in pain, the number of people in foreclosure, well above a million, is going to be the single biggest issue, and one would like to see the candidates deal with it in a much more reasonable and informed manner than either has so far.
If you were to advise these presidential candidates on how to address the current financial crisis, what are some of the top recommendations you'd make?
I would recommend that you cancel the interest payments and do small incremental reductions in the principals on the loans in an effort to safeguard the wealth, knowing full well that many people cannot and will not pay back all the interest and all the principal. And you can put the interest back on the tail end of the loan, you know, 20 years out or something, they can make their interest payments. Because the people also have to feel like all their sweat and all their toil and all their tears, all they do to earn that money and stay in that house, gets them some equity. because otherwise they're working really hard for a house that's declining in value to make payments, much of which are interest payments, for a house their prospects of owning outright in the foreseeable future are very dim. So I don't much think that was a particularly good idea. And I don't much like the pattern of private, untransparent dealings in which some firms are killed and other firms are rescued. And as to the Lehman deal particularly, Lehman should have been saved. Too little was done, and everybody was too smug with the idea that, oh, we don't do bailouts. But, I mean, who are you kidding? You've done 10 this year. Why not this one? Once you start in this business, you know, picking and choosing behind closed doors who lives and who dies on Sunday afternoons with the Treasury and the Federal Reserve and then announcing it as letting the market work its magic is kind of through the looking glass stuff, in my opinion.
That was economist Max Wolf. Read his commentaries online at HuffingtonPost.com.
93.3 WNRB LP Wausau.
The increasing number and growing sophistication of Taliban attacks against the U.S.-led coalition forces in Afghanistan has some observers concluding that the conditions there are the most unstable they've been since the U.S. invasion in 2001. U.S. airstrikes and raids against suspected militants in towns and villages have caused an increasing number of civilian deaths and angry protests against the U.S., NATO, and the American-backed government of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Seeking to neutralize Taliban sanctuaries in neighboring Pakistan, the U.S. has in recent weeks launched a number of raids and missile attacks against Taliban and al-Qaeda targets inside the country. According to press reports, President Bush in July secretly approved U.S. military attacks inside Pakistan without prior authorization from Pakistan's government. Pakistani officials say a September 3rd American raid against the border village of Angur Adda resulted in as many as 20 civilian deaths. On September 15th, Pakistani security forces fired at two U.S. Chinook helicopters and prevented their attempt to land on the Pakistani side of the border, according to local security officials and tribesmen. Pakistan's army said that its forces have orders to open fire if U.S. troops launch another raid across the Afghan border. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anita Weiss, professor of international studies at the University of Oregon, who assesses the negative consequences of unauthorized U.S. military raids inside Pakistan.
Well, my reaction is quite horrified by it, frankly, because when you think about it, the United States is actually engaging in military activity inside of an allied country. Pakistan has expended a lot to try to support the United States in the so-called war against terrorism. You know, after all is said and done, now without consulting with the government of Pakistan and without getting any type of, you know, green light whatsoever, the United States has unilaterally started to actually attack this allied country. If one of the goals of the U.S. government is to try to destabilize this recently democratically elected government, I mean, finally, after so many years, after 9 years of military government, you know, in February of this year, an elected participatory democracy came into power. And if one of the U.S.'s goals is to destabilize that government, then they're doing a good job. But if that's not part of the goals, then I think that a lot of people who are these, you know, so-called foreign policy advisors really need to be replaced, because this is going to be terrible for the future of Pakistan-U.S. relations.
There are reports that a September 3rd U.S. raid inside Pakistan killed an undetermined number of civilians there, and there were many protests among the population of Pakistan against this kind of U.S. military activity inside their nation. What are the short-term and long-term repercussions, you think, for Pakistan and the United States, given the U.S. Goal and mission of reducing violence in Afghanistan and really removing operational bases for the Taliban and al-Qaeda inside Pakistan?
Well, first off, I should clarify one thing. There have been at least 6 or 7 bombings inside of Waziristan in the month of September alone. The short-term implications of this are that for every time the U.S. engages in such practices, I think you're going to be alienating a couple of dozen more Pakistanis. a couple of dozen more people are going to be saying, why are we supporting the United States? Long-term implications, I think that Pakistanis, and especially Pakhtuns in these areas, are not going to forget quickly what happened, and I think that this is very deleterious for the U.S. reputation abroad.
What do you think the motivation here is? Is President Bush trying to gain some more credibility in terms of his legacy as president here by dislodging the Taliban or Al-Qaeda from these Pakistani tribal areas, or maybe with the hope of capturing or killing Osama bin Laden before he leaves office? Do you have any ideas why the Bush administration is doing this now as opposed to maybe several years ago?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think that a lot of people are anticipating some type of an October surprise ahead of the U.S. presidential election, something that will help to get John McCain elected. We have to remember that September 11th, 2001 was already 7 years ago, and that, you know, the immediate action on the part of the U.S. right afterwards was to attack Afghanistan in October of 2001. Whether that was wise or ill-advised or whatever, the reality is that, you know, the news coverage made it seem like the Taliban, their Pakhtun followers, were hiding out in these remote caves without giving any mention to the fact that the United States had supervised the building of that whole cave complex in the early 1980s when the Mujahideen, who we were supporting, were fighting against, you know, the former Soviet Union. So I do think that this is an effort on the part of the Bush administration, at least to try to show that they're still, you know, in the hunt for Osama bin Laden and his senior deputies. But, you know, by going off and wantonly killing civilians like this with no, you know, viable explanation as to why these areas in particular were selected, except to say that they were believed to house terrorist training camps. I'd like to see some actionable intelligence released to the American public saying, what proof did they have that there was some type of training camp going on?
Anita Weiss, there have been reports through the years that the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Agency, and other elements within the Pakistani government are allied with the Taliban and other Islamic militants. Is there a risk at some point if the United States continues to intervene there and cross the border without government authorization? Is there a risk that Islamic militants and their allies could take over Pakistan, a nuclear power, which is quite alarming, of course?
Certainly, U.S. actions like this, they end up in the long term serving to empower those same kind of militant extremist groups that the United States is ostensibly trying to fight against. Actually, I don't think they could find themselves in the seat of power, but I do believe that they could help to agitate to result in a civil war in Pakistan. For quite some time, there's been a real line between the eastern part of Pakistan and the western part of Pakistan. You know, the eastern part, Punjab, Karachi and Sindh there, Islamabad, these are much more liberal in orientation, western-oriented, part of the global economy, whereas you have many parts of the Northwest Frontier Province, Balochistan, and certainly Fatah, the federally administered tribal areas, which are just really not part of the global economy or polity or anything. And there's some very distinct tensions that exist between the eastern and western parts of Pakistan. So I don't think that Pakistan in the foreseeable future can be overcome by militant Islamist groups, but I do think that they can agitate enough to create conditions of a good possibility of civil war in Pakistan.
That was Anita Weiss, professor of international studies at the University of Oregon and co-editor of the book Power and Civil Society in Pakistan. Read more about the current events in Pakistan in the online edition of the English Language Daily Dawn at dawn.com. On August 29th, the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina hitting New Orleans and the Gulf, Hurricane Gustav again threatened the city and the South Louisiana coast. 2 million people evacuated from the area, and the big news was that Gustav did not hit New Orleans. Lost in all the coverage of New Orleans dodging a bullet was any news of where Gustav made landfall. The hurricane had lost a lot of its punch by the time it landed in Cocodrie, about 70 miles southwest of New Orleans, but still downed thousands of trees and knocked out power to most of the state. Wetlands and offshore islands have served for centuries as barriers when hurricanes sweep in from the Gulf of Mexico. But now that so many islands and so many hundreds of square miles of wetlands have been destroyed by oil and gas drilling operations, general development, and the effect of climate change, hurricanes now threaten coastal areas with greater devastation. The more recent destruction wrought by Hurricane Ike on the Texas coast can be attributed in part to improper stewardship of thousands of square miles of wetlands that used to provide natural flood protection. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Carrie St. Pay, the director of the Baratia Terrebonne National Estuary Program in Bayou Country, southwest of New Orleans. He says the heaviest damage from Gustav occurred around Bayou Lafourche and explains what must be done to restore the wetlands.
1,000 years ago, Bayou Lafourche was the Mississippi River. In 1905, it was dammed. And by 1955, it became a stagnant pool, and pumps were put in place to pump water from Mississippi River into Bayou Lafourche. And we've been relying on those pumps ever since. The hurricane caused something I've never seen in my 34-year career. It caused Bayou Lafourche to go anaerobic. In other words, black, smelly water for 40 miles. And Bayou Lafourche is used as a water supply. So this is quite a story. 300,000 people are without a water source right now.
Do you know exactly why that happened?
Yeah, because of the direction of the storm, it forced water movement, sudden water movement, in advance of the hurricane-force winds to stir up the bottom organic matter. And once that was stirred up, the bacteria that decompose such things took over and used up all the oxygen in the water, causing it to go septic.
And what's the situation now? Is it still like that?
Yeah, it is. We have an emergency need to dredge Bayou Lafourche to upper 6.2 miles, and that's taking place beginning next week.
Is that something that's done periodically, or is this a first?
No, this is a first. Bayou Lafourche has become silted in, and it's reached critical levels. It's hampering our ability to get water to the water plants. We have Ike approaching. That's causing surge to come from the Gulf, keeping the water from moving to the south. And it's a big mess right now.
Carrie St. Pay, what impact, if any, do you think Hurricane Gustav had on the wetlands in southern Louisiana?
Well, I flew over it yesterday, and the Barry Islands really took the brunt of the storm. The water level was still very high, so I couldn't tell how much of the marsh was affected. But the only way we're going to rebuild our coast is by pumping sediments from the bottom of the Mississippi River and Chaffalaya River and from offshore sources. And we would sustain that with small to medium water diversions. We have to physically harvest the sediment from the bottom of rivers to rebuild the land.
Last year, a law passed in Congress that would fund projects, a multi-billion-dollar law to fund projects to begin to restore the wetlands, but no money has been appropriated yet. The new governor, Bobby Jindal, has just pledged $300 million from the state surplus, which comes, I guess, from oil and gas royalties, to rebuilding the wetlands. How does that amount of money compare to the need?
It's a drop in the bucket, but it's something. At this point, I'm reaching for anything I can get.
When I visited you in your office in Bayou Country last year, we were talking about the sad state of the wetlands and whether they can be rebuilt in order to once again serve as a storm buffer and a rich ecosystem, and really just to allow a unique way of life to survive. Would you say now that you're more or less hopeful about the future than you were a year ago?
That's hard to say. I'd say I'm more hopeful because of the governor we have, but I don't know where the money's going to come from.
That was Carrie St. Pay of the Barratia Terrebonne National Estuary Program based in Thibodaux, Louisiana. Contact the group at 1-800-259-0869. Or visit their website at btnep.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Elaine Osowski, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Did you know that Barack Obama blames the Bush-McCain policies for the recent economic downturn? But John McCain supports our economy and thinks it's the greatest in the world. Maybe someone should ask Barack Obama why he hates America's economy. Call Barack Obama and tell him to let our economy win.
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
Wake up.
Sunday mornings, the irreverent Uncle Pete. With your Sunday morning soft start, 8 to 10 a.m.
You must wake up.
Uncle Pete will bring you a kinder, gentler radio wake-up call.
Come on, wake up.
That's Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m.
Wake up, love.
That soft starts Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m. Only on 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau.
GlaxoSmithKline would make if I was diagnosed. Depression is a symptom of a society that's failed. My children will not grow up in a prison. Quit your stupid job, you stupid slave. Yourself will be extorted. Rather the cops get used for the opposite. Home of a headache only gets worse. Dying in the waste of a jar. Be chucking the graffiti on a billboard. Voted off with a retired Bible from a conscience. You will have a perfect life. You must have a perfect life.
If you refuse to accept Thanksgiving celebrations, there is no medication when you feel like a knife.
Everything gets apathy. The hologram. Stronger than we think we are. Filled with exhaust and a mess. And the opiates made for religion and fashion.
This is a crisis, let's go to the beach, walk into the ocean, it's a sea.
This is a crisis, let's go to the beach, walk into the ocean, it's a sea.
This is a crisis, let's go to the beach, walk into the ocean, it's a sea.
This is a crisis, let's go to the beach, walk into the ocean,
when a thermometer threatens the boil to exertion, a bite's on stroke.
At that time, life almost means ice, cause the desert is cold.
Here's news, freedom banker invades Lewis Price Field, inventing a new car for a new world.
Do you value quality and comfort as well as agility and speed? Would you rather have a safe car with no dream, no safety and dream? In London, they warn you when the door's about to be closed. Where I'm from, they tell you after the fact that Mayflower and Pinto were slavery ships. They say I'm cynical, as they do it to themselves. This is a crisis, they go to the beach, walk into the ocean and secede.
It is indeed a crisis.
This is a crisis, they go to the beach, walk into the ocean and secede.
My ex-governor's an ex-Nazi son.
This is a crisis, let's go to the beach, walk into the ocean and secede.
Save the deficit.
Soon the
off a tree, at the office, in my bedroom. On the underground, on the park with Elvis. In Nicaragua, blindfolded in my studio. On the underground, the park with Elvis. In Nicaragua, blindfolded in my studio.
Up a tree, at the office, in my bedroom. On the underground, on the park with Elvis. In Nicaragua, blindfolded in my studio. Here, everything is perfect.
From where Winston stood, it was possible to read, picked out on his white face in elegant lettering, the three slogans of the party. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
I remember how the meaning of words began to change. How unfamiliar words like collateral and rendition became frightening. While things like Northfire and the Articles of Allegiance became powerful. I remember how different became dangerous. I still don't understand it. Why they hate us so much.
I want this country to realize that we stand on the edge of oblivion. I want every man, woman, and child to understand how close we are to chaos. I want everyone to remember why they need us.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. Revolution without dancing is a revolution not worth having.
Baby, I'm an anarchist, your spineless liberal.
I'm not afraid, I have enough fight, and I'm not ashamed about getting drunk. And I don't care what you say, cause I believe in anarchy. I'm not afraid. And I'm not ashamed. Cause I'm still believing.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
I'm with another gentleman here who's at the anti-Nazi protests. And I
this is Mike Cannon. I'm with Becca, who has returned from Palestine for the fourth time.
I'm with a vendor at the energy fair here who has biodiesel.
This is Mike Cannon. I'm with a group, the RNC Welcoming Committee for the Republican National Convention that's going to be coming up.
Need is still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town, like in the 9th Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So
stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
And you too can stay current by checking out the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m. on this, your only not-for-profit, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
My darling, I'm waiting for you. How long is the day in the dark? Or a week?
You'll never grow old, Michael. And you'll never die.
I am so, so sorry for everything that has happened. Because it's
spite of what Mike says now, it is my fault. Everything had to be my way. And this is where we've ended up. Hungry. And cold. And hunted.
Crazy Man Michael.
Thanks for tuning into this week's show. The Mike Cannon Show is produced for not-for-profit, community, and or micro-power radio use worldwide at the Glee Glee Studios. Executive producer is David Preckel with technical and web assistance from Michael Redfox. So as long as we don't have a complete financial meltdown between now and next week, and as long as there's still power to run this show, I'll be forever yours in the struggle. Mike Cannon.
Like a monkey ready to be shot into space. Space monkey, ready to sacrifice himself for the greater good.
Barbiturate, who in these realms above, who by by something blind, ooh, by avalanche, ooh, by powder, ooh, for his greed, ooh, for his hunger, and ooh, shall I say, is calling. Who by accident, who in solitude, who in this mirror, who by his latest command, who by his own hand, who in mortal chains, who in power, and who shall I say is calling.
One day we'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. We're slowly learning that fact.